for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
This week is episode 374 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. It's time for another doubleheader week here at the podcast with two great Kickstarter-related interviews. First up is Gilbert Del Trez, creator of many good books including Under the Flesh and Lair, and he's got another good book right now on Kickstarter called Pistolera, and I'm sure I'm butchering that. You'll hear him say it much better than I will during the interview. It's a discussion about a female lead who's strong, but she also happens to be with child, and she's looking for revenge. It's set in a specific time period, and we'll discuss why Gil chose that, as well as what other good projects he has coming up. Then everything wraps up with Lyndon White, an accomplished comics artist who has a Kickstarter of his own. And this one is focusing on his H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds concertina book. We talk about how this book came to be and what exactly a concertina book is, as well as why he chose it and what kinds of good things he might have coming our way in the future. I had great talks with both of these guys, so I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show.
Let me tell you about this pistolera. She looks meaner than any two-bit hombre. She's got a pouch on her bigger than a pot-bellied pig, and eyes that burn right off through your soul. Never seen a woman so scorned. Snap a trigger so fast, faster than a crack of lightning. She's worse than a killer, because she leaves you living with something missing. I don't know the devil in her details. That makes her a devil herself. If you varmints want to know her story, you need to start backing. You can't make this whole kit and caboodle without you. This one here is a blood-soaked tale of scorn and vengeance, unlike anything you ever seen. Trust me, you ain't gonna wanna miss this one, partner.
It's always great to talk with Gilbert Del Trez, the creator of such good things as Under the Flesh and Lair, and has something new going on Kickstarter. How are you doing today, Gil?
Wayne, how's it going? Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, why don't you tell people what it is you've got on Kickstarter right now? We'll catch up on the other stuff later.
Okay, sounds good. Sounds good. So at the moment, I've delved into the Western genre. I have Pistolera right now going on. It's what I like to call a blood-soaked tale of scorn and vengeance. And the premise surrounds a pregnant Mexican teen who is seeking vengeance against the sheriff who raped her by learning the ways of the gun from her estranged fugitive brother.
Hmm. Now, on the website, too, it also says, think Kill Bill meets Desperado.
Yeah, I was trying to think of something catchy. I mean, it is a revenge Western, and I couldn't think of anything better than Kill Bill. Just because there's a correlation with the vengeance, that's a theme that runs real high with that narrative. And then Desperado, just for the imagery, and then the culture with the Mexican assassins with the guitar case. So because I have a Mexican protagonist here that's on a vendetta trail, I felt those two would kind of help visualize for backers what to kind of expect with Pistolera.
Now, another thing it says on your Kickstarter page is it's inspired by the brave women who fought in the Mexican Revolution. Mm-hmm. So I don't know much about that situation. Were there a lot of women that fought in the Mexican Revolution?
Well, here's the thing. There were quite a few. And I kind of, in doing research for Pistolera, I was kind of trying to find, looking up, female cowboys or something like that. And I put in, the term for cowboy in Spanish is vaquero, V-A-Q-U-E-R-O, vaquero. Mm-hmm. So then I put vaquera, and then I came across all these this imagery of the woman of the Mexican Revolution, and apparently that was a thing that I wasn't aware of. So I, you know, I just kind of got influenced from that for Pistoleta, because I felt it could be kind of true towards the time and towards you know, the Western genre. And a lot of people that wouldn't know otherwise, myself included in that, you know, would often overlook that women indeed, you know, fought in wars, at least Mexican women in the revolution.
Now, she's a little different, though. She's pregnant, is my understanding of the story. Is this a real thing that happened? I mean, were there women that were fighting while they were pregnant?
No, I wouldn't say that. The women of the Mexican Revolution, they fought, and they wanted to overthrow one of the generals at the time. But the fact that she's pregnant was something that I kind of instilled to make this particular Western somewhat different. Mm-hmm. Like, I know we've seen women as leads in a Western before, mm-hmm. and it's not common and maybe not as popular, but it's happened. So for me, it's like whenever you bring something to the table, you kind of want to bring something new and fresh. I mean, we've seen thousands of revenge stories done, even in Westerns. Everything was revenge against something, you know, outlaws killing somebody, or a sheriff trying to, you know, or a bounty hunter. It's always something with a revenge in there. It's always what stirs the pot. So for me, I'm like, what could I make something different? OK, I said I can do the Mexican woman as a protagonist to be something different. I can make her a teen. Mm-hmm. Right. And then to add more weight on it, that she's pregnant, or, you know, she becomes pregnant through her ordeal. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, yeah, not that the Mexican woman, you know, fought pregnant. I mean, if they did, that was a tough ass woman. If there is one, I wouldn't put it past me. But in this particular case, I just wanted to create a protagonist that was not what you'd seen cut from the same old cloth as far as what we get from a Western. Mm-hmm.
She's pretty far along if the graphics are representative of what the, you know, what's going on in the story. I don't know. Pregnant women I've known have never been able to do those kinds of things this far along. So she must be something special.
Well, the way I had it is, of course, anytime you think of a revenge story that hinges upon a woman being raped or something, it's difficult. It's tough. So the way I had it is, in the beginning of the story, she comes across the antagonist, and he ends up killing her family. He wants to take a plot of land. And what happens is he leaves her alive, but he kind of says, you know, I'm going to take something, you know, that'll make you a woman. And, you know, he takes her virginity. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of cut and paste to like the transition to like literally the next page is like 8 months later. And we see her, you know, kind of far along in her term. Mm-hmm. So during the time, it's like she doesn't find out she's pregnant. It's just she wants to go through revenge, but then she finds out she's pregnant, and in wanting to get revenge and in learning the ways of the gun, she's doing this while she is pregnant. First month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. She's going all along through this. Mm.
Ouch.
So trying to do something different. Yeah. Just so, you know, definitely when you come later on, it's going to be harder to do anything. But I thought that would just make it a little bit different. And I feel the story I put together comes across as believable for the time and even her journey. Not that I'm just throwing that she was pregnant and she wants to learn the gun at 8 months already, about to, you know, be childbearing. I just had like a progression, the stages. And it just happens, you know, as she's going through the stages of learning and becoming a master gunslinger, she's, you know, adding more time in her pregnancy. This is how it happened.
So she's, all this activity is delaying the birth, or I'm trying to figure out how this works.
Not really. She's just the way the story happens. I come in, like you see some flashbacks going in on what happened with her. And then you kind of see how she became a gunslinger and that path. And then we come to present day where she's just 8 months in her term. She's not fully 9 months in yet, but where she's ready and capable enough to, where she feels as a gunslinger to enact revenge, or at least seek it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. This will be interesting, because we've talked about this probably before, is that I like female leads in stories. So I'm always interested, particularly in a strong female lead. I always tell the story, and people may get tired of hearing it, but I have female friends who always think that a woman protagonist should be maternal, and by that they mean they would talk their problems out. They're not action oriented. They want to sit down over tea and discuss things and stuff like that. And I always say, you're really limiting women characters when you do that. And your character is nothing like that. I mean, my friends might not be, they might be surprised by this one, as we have to say with that.
Well, if the forest sitting down and having tea, how would that work for Sarah Connor, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of my favorite female heroes, heroines, or protagonists is Sarah Connor in the first Terminator. I don't know. I fell in love with her. Just how tough she was and everything that she was going through. And she was just a waitress. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of see her go through all this. And the fact that she survived, you know, a Terminator and Michael Biehn, you know, the one who impregnates her with, you know, who will be John Connor. He ended up dying. Like, I just something about her, it mystified me. I just thought it was the power. She was powerful. Vulnerable, yes, but you saw the stages of growth with her. Mm-hmm. And even Ellen Ripley is another one of my favorite female protagonists in general. But since we're just saying, you know, she's just one, but okay, she happens to be female. Mm-hmm. So the fact that she could, you know, take out, you know, the alien in part one, and just the way she did it was just incredible. There's no fear. And again, we see the progression. So with Pistoletta, I have Under the Flesh on hold, but that's like zombie type horror, my love letter to that. Mm-hmm. I have Lair, which is more supernatural, demonic horror, different like dimensional type stuff going on. So that's different. There's a spiritual message in there too. So that's something that I thought would be kind of cool and different. And I was able to do that. And then the Western genre was something, I grew up with that. My pops love Westerns. And I'm like, I always wanted to do my own Western. And I'm like, what could I do that could be different, but still engaging and challenging and fun, and still show, hey, you know what, we could make a powerful female character, but not tie a feminist agenda to anything. Just let the story flow for itself. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of just what I wanted to do with this one.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I got to ask, is she patterned after someone you know? Is she something that your imagination came up with? How did you set her up to be the character she is?
So in doing research for this piece, I'm trying to figure out, you know, the surrounding story. I mean, you have to have something. And I did a lot of research on the Mexican-American War. And I know Texas was controlled by Mexico for a time, and during that time they still had quite a few Mexicans in, you know, occupying Texas. And then after the war they were, you know, being driven out and stuff. So I felt this time period where the Mexican-American War kind of, you know, concluded, and we now have Texas emerging as the Lone Star Republic, as its own republic, you know, the Republic of Texas, I felt like, you know, you still have families, Mexican families that are still there living in Texas, that are being driven off. So I felt like, okay, here's where I can kind of benchmark her beginning. I could have where they just own this plot of land and you know, the war is over and you got this sheriff that just like, hey, this is our land now and we kind of want this property here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sheriff is driving the family off and, you know, the dad, of course, this is my land. I don't want to leave, or this is my home at least, not land. Okay, you go, but this is my home. This is all I know. You know, he gets driven off. They get killed by the sheriff. She sees that, and the sheriff doesn't kill her. I mean, just he couldn't kill her, but he took advantage of her and just, you know, get out of here, whatnot. And he takes over that plot of land, and she is hell-bent on this vengeance that she seeks out her brother or estranged brother, and he's kind of, you know, she blames him for the parents' death because he just wanted to do his own thing. And a lot of times in that culture where where you grew up, sometimes you can't do your own thing. You got to kind of force them what the family tells you. But he was his own man. He left and did his own thing. Pistoletta, our main character, she was able to find and track him down, tell the news of what happened to the family, and want him to teach her the ways of the gun. And he doesn't even want to teach her the ways. He thinks it's a joke, you know, women, you know, learning guns, that, you know, he sees it as a joke kind of thing. But again, she's so determined, and he's like, okay, well, you really want to do this? All right, we're going to run you through the gauntlet. We're going to put you through the gamble. Let's see how bad you want it. And he takes her to this hellish, you know, journey that she overcomes to get to that point where she's capable of, you know, exacting that revenge. So that's how the landscape kind of pieced around the like her side story or the background, where I felt this would be a good place to start a story. And then I felt this is where a female character and a teen character at that, you know, maybe like in her 16, 17, she could be. I never specify the age, but, you know, I kind of just leave that. So I guess the imagination, I don't nail it on the head what her age is, but she is a teen. But she goes through, I guess, or becomes a woman or rite of passage within that time, 8 months throughout her pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what time period this is? Is this 1850s, 1860s, something like that?
Yeah, like I want to say like the 1850s, 1840s, late 1840s, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, as I read the Kickstarter page, it says this is a 30-page one-shot graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're doing is you're funding the artwork, the lines, the colors, and the letters, as well as the cover printing and the cover of the printing and shipping of rewards to the backers. I'm just kind of curious, a 30-page one-shot, that's going to be kind of interesting to see how that, I mean, if you're going to sell this individually, you probably won't know how much it would be cover price if you were going to do it as a one-shot like that.
If I go to a con and start selling, which I hope I can do with this one, I know it's just a 30-page. Mm-hmm. My idea, just to fund this Kickstarter, mm-hmm. give the backers their rewards, I would kind of do what I did with Lair, bring it to Indiegogo to give people who support that platform a chance to look at Pistoleta, because I've realized that there's some people who are exclusive to Kickstarter no matter what. Mm-hmm. There's some people that are exclusive to Indiegogo. Mm-hmm. So me, I'm not prominent creator. I don't have my audience. I'm just finding it out. I'm still growing in what I'm doing. So I feel like I can, if I'm able to fund Pistoleta on Kickstarter, I can do maybe a small 1,000, 1,500 goal for Pistoleta on Indiegogo to get a bigger print run. And there I would do the 30 page and I would have it like a card stock with like a little binding. And I would probably charge, I want to say, like just $10 flat. And I know it's kind of pricey, but, you know, I guess dressing it up with the card stock kind of will up it up a little bit. There's this graphic novel I bought. It's Aliens graphic novel from Mike Mignola. Mm-hmm. And it's in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And it was just a one shot. And it was just a Christian guy. Somehow he gets thrown up in a whole Aliens, you know, it's a little side story within the Aliens universe. Mm-hmm. And I like Mignola's art, and I was just, I don't know, for some reason I was just in the mood to read an Alien book. So I was just Googling what are the top, you know, narratives that came out or graphic novels. And when I saw this graphic novel, it must have been like maybe 30, 35 pages, if that. And it had a cardstock, and it even had a binding. It actually had a little binding where you could just see Aliens. It said Mignola. It said Dark Horse. And I got to thinking, I'm like, if I package that, you know, for Pistoleta, I think I can, you know, charge $10 for a complete story, one of a kind, you're not going to get anywhere else, and do it in that way where, you know, genuinely, I don't think it'd go for that much, but I would have to do it like that. If I'm doing it as a floppy, you can't charge, you know, $10, but at least with the card stock, you know, one shot, you know, hopefully, you know, I can get away and people would still kind of dig the premise enough to, you know, put in $10 for an indie project like that. That's the hope.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's got some unusual things going on with it. You know, you've got a diverse character. Not only do you have a strong woman, but she's a diverse woman as well. Mm-hmm. And it's in an era, as you point out in here, that a world of masculine gunslinging vaqueros. You know, mm-hmm. it's for a woman to excel at that time was a little tough because they expected you to stay, you know, always talk about being in the kitchen and stuff like that. And this is a case where she's not doing that. She's actually being her own person. She has to stand up for herself. There is no male to help her with that. So it supports that. I mean, that's something I think people today could get into. And mm-hmm. I'm just kind of interested, too, because, again, this is a time period I don't know much about. So for me, mm-hmm. I always like to read books. I don't know if you've mm-hmm. ever heard, read Yi Sun Shin, which is by Henri. And I always am interested because I didn't know anything about that part of the world during the time the book is settled in. And I really learned a lot. And hopefully with this, too, you said you've done your research. This will be something we'll learn some things as well as get a good story.
Yeah, and doing the research, like I know I said inspired by the women of the Mexican Revolution. The revolution happened after that time period. I think the revolution happened within the early 1900s. Mm. And these women that fought alongside the men, they were called soldaderas. Those are like just a female soldier. And so where I guess you could say where Pistolera comes into play just before this time, you could kind of say like she was just brave enough or bold enough to usher in that type of, you know, fearless woman or just woman that would just do what it takes, even learn the ways of the gun. So there is that, but that time period, I feel like I know racism is a touchy subject and I know it could be taboo, but I mean, the fact of the matter is things happen and it's just the world that we live in and there's just bad people in the world and there's also good people in the world. So the reason why I chose this time, and I know also research I did around that time, around the 1850s, around there, once Texas became its own republic, they had like the Rangers, the Texas Rangers patrolling the borders. And there was a lot of, I guess you could say, Mexicans that were caught either crossing the border or whatnot, even at that time, and along with slaves, runaway slaves, that type of thing, that they were lynched and they were hung as a spectacle, right? So you even had children watching this, or the higher class aristocratic people watching this happen. And I'm like, man, this is crazy. And something like that it's not really made known unless you go look for that, you know, I kind of found it within my research. So I felt like even though I don't get heavily into that in my story, mm-hmm. it's just people who know the history, know that time could kind of see like, okay, I get why this particular sheriff is racist mm-hmm. or just kind of really, I guess, strong and just, you know, racist remarks or whatnot. Because that was just how it was at the time. Does that mean every single, you know, person was racist to that degree? No. Because on the flip side, there are people who saw other people as equals. Like if you look at slavery, right, you know, they quote the good book, hey, honor your master, right? If not, you know, get a couple lashes here and there. The good book tells you got to honor your, you know, honor your master. But in the same page, or if the flip side to that is, you know, in the Bible, it also says, hey, you know, masters would treat your slaves like you would your brother. Treat them as your brother. Mm-hmm. So treat them as equals. So for even though there was heavy racism around that time, there was still people that fought against it. Although probably, you know, they couldn't be as vocal as now with through social media and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's something that it underlies my book, although I don't focus too heavy on it. Mm-hmm. But it's indicative of the time. And if I ever would do something bigger with this, or if I ever continue it, then I could kind of dig into that just a little bit. But not so to make it political, just to just show like, hey, you can have a story that, you know, you have opposing factions, or you can have, you know, even heavy provoking subject matter as far as racism is concerned, but not make that the whole driving force, but just have it, you know, be true to your characters is what I kind of want to do. Mm-hmm. As far as the book, so that's kind of what also had me want to make it around this time period as well.
Mm-hmm. Now before we get too far into it, I want to make sure we talk about the fact that it's due on you have to get your goal of $4,000 by Friday, April the 5th at 7:57 p.m. Eastern time. And so you've got a good start going, and you know you need the help too to make this happen, which is almost always the case when Casey's Kickstarter. When you out of the gate suddenly get your goal, well, you know, those are rare circumstances. So if you go to Kickstarter and look up Pistolera, and you say it better than I ever can. So if you get there and look for that, you'll be able to find it and support it. And you know this will. We're recording it a little ahead of the release on the Sunday, but I just want to make sure that people get out there and don't wait until things come near the end. It's always better to come in and kind of relieve the creators from the daily heart attack of looking out there and seeing if something actually, did somebody donate today? Oh no, nobody donated. We don't want to see that. You want to be able to get the goal and then go on from there.
Yeah, for sure. I do have a stretch goal in mind, but again, the stresses or the pressure, I mean, that's why I did it for 20 days, 21 days. I figured that's 3 weeks. Just because when I've done Under the Flesh, I think for a month, you had like a 2 week lull where it's just like the middle of the campaign, you know, it's like nothing going on. Like in the beginning and this kind of midway second week, you got a little traction. Then there was like a week and a half, almost 2 weeks for nothing going on. Then the last week you kind of get some movement. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like, you know what, just keep it 20 days so that I'm always active and I have Mateo, the artist on there, you know, active as well, and try to keep the fire hot always. But it's, I hate crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. It's just the stress that comes with it. I just, you know, this is what it is. You're trying to sell a product and you need people's money, and it's just, that's the only way you can do it. So I just try to put a good product out, keep it high quality, and just bring something fresh for someone of that genre to give it a chance.
And keep going through social media. It's one of the things you got to do. You're probably going to be on Facebook and other places like that more than you usually are. So we'll see you doing those kinds of things, which is good. Now, you mentioned Mateo, and that's I wanted to get into the artwork a little bit, because this time the artist on your series, it's Mateo Martinez.
Yes.
How did you hook up with him to do the artwork on this series?
All right. So I found, you know what, on Instagram, I don't know. I think I was following him. I don't know from where or when. It was like when I just logged on to Instagram and I saw him. He had a webcomic called Jetpack Activate, but that was his handle. And I kind of saw he had like this cartoony art style. It wasn't too gritty. But it was, it had a style that I liked. It just, for me, it brought character. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of simple. Mm-hmm. So ideally I would have probably liked to go with a more serious artist, but at the same time, I felt like Mateo's style is doing something different, because it's a style you'd normally see something, more, I guess, child friendly, more, you know, it wouldn't be so grim, it wouldn't be so dark. You know, it has a kind of like a Disney-esque quality to his artwork. So I felt this cartoony style, this cartoonish, I felt like, you know what, if you put that in a really dark, dark story, I don't know, for some reason, I think it made it, I don't know if it's an art thing, if it didn't make it as grim, mm-hmm. but it just still made it seem like, hey, you still got something hopeful maybe to look forward to, as dark as that sounds. Mm-hmm. But it's just the polarity of that type of style, you know, with dark subject matter, I just felt it's not something I've seen in comics. And if there's someone that does that, let me know, because that'd be awesome. I'd be intrigued to check out their work. But that's just what got me attached to him. He had a good rate, which was kind of friendly. And I kind of told him, hey, listen, I kind of want to crowdfund this. I said, so how about I just pay you for the first couple pages, and then we just kind of, you know, put the pitch out there and see what we can do. And I think when I wrote him the script, there's only 12 pages in or 13 pages, and he liked it. He liked it. He's like, I want to know more. So, you know, I finished that script and I had him look over it. He did some thumbnails, and, you know, now we just want to get to where we could, you know, actually ink and get this done. And I have, JL Giles actually from Under the Flesh. He did the banner for us. He did two alternate covers, and, he's going to do the coloring also of Pistoleta. So, you know, he's a maestro when it comes to colors, when it comes to artwork in general. So I felt like him and Mateo paired up is just something different, for this Western. I felt like it evoked a Western piece and feel, grim story, and just that cartoonish art, I felt, went hand in hand. It was just something different.
Now, as far as like the coloring goes, it's interesting to bring JL. There's two variant covers, one that has like a sepia tone feel to it and the one that's more realistic color. And then when you go into the preview pages that you have, there's interesting choices of colors. There's a lot of sepia tone, but there's a butterfly that's pink stands out. And then when you look at the eyes of the sheriff, it's clearly blue. Mm-hmm. And then when we get to the 8 months later page that you talked about, it seems to be full color. Are you going to alternate that, or are the CP tone pages basically for the past, and then we get to the present, it's going to be full color?
That's exactly how it's going to be. There's going to be spots where we jump back and forth, so we will have sepia for that. So you know this is a flashback. So kind of like you see the flashback happen, then 8 months later, we're back in present time, and then we kind of go on her story. We're going to see what she did in a couple months in, what she learned, how she got through her journey, that arduous road to get where she got. Those little bits and pieces will be handled in sepia. And then we're in present time. We got this awesome, awesome looking color work that JL put together here. Mm-hmm.
Now, I noticed, too, that you've got in your rewards, you've got... I don't see many people that advertise multiple copies of their books. You've got actually some of them, there's 10 copies and 5 copies. And then there's the Wanted Edition that has 3 variants, 4 extra digital comics, and other things like that, including the Wanted poster and an art commission and stuff like that. So you're pushing in a lot of good stuff in there to get people to kind of support it. I mean, if you know people who are would be interested in this book, I would say that you'd want to jump on the on that pledge level, because then you can give it out, because this will all come up. According to what I see, a lot of it's going to happen in August, and that's a good time to get your holiday shopping done, so you could get all this good stuff and then get have this ready to give out for the holidays.
You know? Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't even think of that, even as a marketing angle.
Yeah, because I'm always interested to see when things come out, because there's something about the holiday time of year when there's a lot of gift giving going on. It's a perfect time to have these things to give, particularly if you want to encourage diversity in people's reading. And, you know, I love variety, and so for me, I'm looking forward to it from that respect. So I'm just sort of curious, though. It's really, I haven't seen many people on Kickstarter sell multiple copies of the books. Was that something you thought of, or is that, have you seen that before? Maybe it's just something I haven't come across before.
To be honest with you, I know we're just used to just like the one copy and that's it, and that's just what I kind of been used to. But I had a buddy on mine's on Facebook. He said, I want 2 copies. And I'm like okay, I didn't think of that. So I'm like, man, I don't want to just have someone back $10 again. You know, I'm like, maybe I could just put something and just take a little bit off. And that's where we had the $18 for 2. And then you could pick between either it's just the original cover or one with the color variant, or one either just 2 variants or 2 other variants. So that kind of spawned from him. So I figured it also balances the pledge levels as well, because I have $10. And then instead of jumping straight to 50 or 40, I'm like, you know what? We have a digital bundle at 20. Let me just add 2 copies. Just, I don't know, sometimes people want to give a copy to a friend, or sometimes they just want to have one to just keep in a plastic and the other one to just read. And, you know, when Pistoletta blows up and becomes a Netflix deal and becomes a movie and it gets, you know, all this good stuff happens, right, Wayne? The dream scenario, right? Maybe they'll think that I have something valuable or, you know, that's kind of, I didn't even think of even adding a signed copy. That was just my fault there. Maybe I'll just kind of in the update say, you know, if we fund this level and this level will be automatically signed. So maybe I'll just save that for those who, you know, like collector type stuff.
Well, this could work on Netflix very well. I think Netflix does these kind of stories. So I think this would do it.
I thought it would be cool, and that's, you know, just something fun and different. And I saw something on Netflix. It was the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, just Joel Ethan Coen doing their take on Western stories with some other, I think, directors. And I saw the first 2 stories. I didn't get too much deep into it, but it was as good, man. If you like Westerns, you love it. You know, it's like, wow. It shows you that the Western genre ain't never, ever, ever going to die out. Mm-hmm. So I hope to add to that, you know, with Pistoletta. So that's just kind of what I'm doing.
I always love to tell the story. My dad loved Gunsmoke, and I used to rag on him all the time. Oh, Dad, nobody watches Westerns anymore. Why do you sit and watch that? But now I wish, you know, since then he's passed, and I would love to tell him, because I've had a chance to actually watch Gunsmoke, and I really enjoy the show. And so I wish I could tell him now how wrong I was and how much that I enjoyed the show.
Right? It happens, though. It happens that way. You appreciate it later on.
Yeah. Okay, so it's Pistolera, and you say it much better. Why don't you go ahead and say it again, because you say it better than I do.
Oh, Pistolera?
Yeah. I don't say it quite that with the finesse that you do. It's out there on Kickstarter. You want to get there before Friday, April 5 at 7:57, so that you can get in there. But don't wait until that time. Now is the time to get out there and support the book and make it happen. And so, well, why don't we update people on let's your other projects? I know Lair came out. I got the book in the mail. How did that do it? How'd that work out?
It was very difficult. The Kickstarter, I was able to get it funded, but after the processing fees and after their cut and decline cards or cards that unprocessed or whatnot, I didn't get quite the amount I needed to finish the book. So a lot of it had to come out of pocket, and that kind of delayed a lot of stuff. Printing as well. So it kind of handicapped me a little bit. But again, as a creator, you got to make sure that people get their stuff. Mm-hmm. So then once I was able to get the book done, then it was a matter of finding a printer. Mm-hmm. And the printer that I originally had scheduled for Lair, it just fell through. I kind of contacted them, emailed them back and forth. Okay, yeah, email me now. We're playing email tag. And then it was what should have been, I think, like within a week. So secure the order was taking like almost upwards of a month. Mm-hmm. And I kind of posted updates on Lair to show how transparent I was through the process, you know, copying and pasting the email, except just crossing out names or whatnot. So I eventually settled on Kraken Print. They did a great job, mm-hmm. and I was able to get, you know, the backers their books. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't left with much copies as far as to go to conventions and sell. There was much left over. So I said, you know what? I'm like, I know I got a great book going on. I'm like, I can't just leave Lair just as that. You know, I said, let me try to do something, you know, something else. Let me just think out of the box. So I said, you know what? Indiegogo is this other platform, and it does pretty well as well. So I mean, I think there's maybe a misconception that only Kickstarter is the top place for books, but Indiegogo is showing that they're up there. Mm-hmm. But again, everyone has their preference. So the thing with Indiegogo, when you back it, you automatically get charged. With Kickstarter, you back it, you got to wait to the end of the campaign before you can collect. So that's one thing. So when you back it, it gets charged right away. You know that money's in the bank. I think the fee is a little bit smaller or a little bit less than what the Kickstarter fees are. And then they have what's flexible option where, hey, if you put your goal as 4,000, but you got 3,200, you can collect the 3,200 as a flexible option. So they have that Kickstarter, you know, it's all in or nothing. So I was like, let me put Lair up for those who haven't seen it, and I'll put a small goal for a bigger print run. So I put $1,000 as my goal. I put it flexible, but it did really well. It made, I think, close to $7,000.
Wow.
So that helped me with a big print run. I got a 500 copy print run that's in the works. So that's going to satisfy almost 200 backers on Indiegogo. That back layer, we're gonna have a little $300 excess of units that I can sell at a convention. I'm looking to do Tampa Bay Comic Con as my first convention as a seller. So I get to be doing what my boy Rich Rivera and you would do. Finally be able to do that and get my word, get some more exposure going on. And Indiegogo helped out a lot, and the backers there, the backers on Kickstarter that made it happen. So I'm trying to see if I can do that same kind of little routine with Pistoleta. Hopefully it funds where I can do a bigger print one, because the expenses get really tough.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. I'm glad you figured that way out, because I always ask people which one they prefer, and they almost always go Kickstarter, but Indiegogo has benefits too, and I think that people shouldn't just think Kickstarter only. You should be able to do more than one kind of thing in a crowdfunding way, so I think that's good.
I think audience helps too, since I don't have an audience. It's not like I have like the little audience I have through the Kickstarters that I did, but I still haven't been able to keep like any kind of steam going on. Cause when Under the Flesh was doing well, I know JL had some Marvel work that he was doing, and I did toss the idea around of changing the team, and I did do that. But at the end of the day, I'm like, you know what? I just like, you know what? Let me have this team. I have them something with Lair. I said, let me see, you know, let me put Under the Flesh aside, because I still want to finish that with JL. You know, mm-hmm. is that was his, that was our baby, you know, and I know that the Lair team is capable, very capable. I just kind of want to still, I guess I have that hope where, you know, JL and I could kind of iron out our schedules and come back to this. Mm-hmm. And working on Pistoleta is a good sign. And I think it'll be like the grand hurrah for Under the Flesh. So I know I got a little audience with that. Mm-hmm. Lair has its own little audience. I got a second little coming on Indiegogo. I'm still in the infancy, although I've been doing this for over 6 years through crowdfunding, but my path has been a little bit more brutal. But I'm working out the kinks. I'm getting the learning curve, and I'm hopefully getting to consistency as a creator, so that way people can just see what I'm doing, see what I'm about, and my audience could grow. And because there's some people that will stick to Kickstarter because they got their audience there. Mm-hmm. And I think Bob Valley of Salvagers, you know, he has his audience there. There's a lot of people that just they have their audience there. So why change? If you got a great audience there and you're funding and overfunding, they don't need to change. Don't need to even move back and forth. I get that. Mm-hmm. I'm not of that ilk, so I have to, you know, find a way to survive and thrive crowdfunding until, you know, I'll get more stability.
Well, your real life has gotten in the way of some of the comics that you've had to make. You have a child now, and you have all kinds of good things going on in your personal life. Yeah. So, you know, doing the comics is kind of, you know, it's got to take a back seat to real life.
And that's the problem. I work in a high school as a social service worker. Mm-hmm. So, you know, life coach, counselor, you know, mediator, what have you, working with teachers, students and all that. And it's a great job. And I love that job. It's impactful and help out the urban youth there. But then you also got family time at home. Wife wants to spend time with you. You got your, you know, a newborn son you got to spend time with. So it's like juggling work life, family life and comic books. That's a hard juggle, and I don't want to let the comic thing slip away, because I'm too determined. This fire burns too much inside.
Yeah. Well, the good thing is that you know, you're upfront about it, and you tell people what's going on, and that's the important thing. Is that, you know, it's the people who suddenly just vanish and nobody knows what happened, you know. And there's some people on Kickstarter who I was reading an article where people were talking about Kickstarters that were never fulfilled, that people never got any of the stuff. They made their goal and they made lots of money, but they did not fulfill their promises and stuff. And so I think you do a good job of keeping your promises kept. And I think that's a good sign as far as the future. But you have touched on my favorite book of yours, and that's Under the Flesh. That's how I first got to read your work. And I still am dying to know what's going to happen next in Under the Flesh. So I know that these other projects are good for you, but if I had to if you had to vote, I would vote for Under the Flesh, you know, when you get a chance. But I know that as a creator, you want to do what you feel strongly to create at the time. But if you could ever get back to Under the Flesh, I would really enjoy that.
Oh, Under the Flesh has a special place, and I'm so hard headed. I want to finish that one with JL, and I know we're busy. We got our own projects, but I kind of told JL this is where we're at right now. So it's on recording. It's on record, right, so to speak. We have plans for Pistoletta, which we're doing. Hopefully, we can fund that. He can color that. He's working on his own book, Herbert West Reanimator, like his own take on that, which is excellent. I had the privilege of reading the first book. He even gave me an editor credit, and I helped out in the best way I could. And I think that's going to be something special. Then after that, there's still something we want to do together. I said, we'll do that. Okay, we're kind of like talking about a one-shot, 60-page one-shot deal, black and white, just to, you know, get the juices together, us back as a team. Then I said, after that, we got to go back to Under the Flesh. We got to finish this. We got unfinished business. And he said he's up for that. That's what we're looking at. So
very cool. Well, I'd love to see it.
The Flesh is a special, special place. And I got everything written out. I got it. Everything written out. And I ended on a nice cliffhanger to keep it going. It goes in ways you wouldn't expect. Trust me, Under the Flesh is not dead at all. Okay. It's just, I think by the time I'm growing myself as a writer and one of these projects I'm doing with JL and my with Sebastian from Lair, like I'm going as a creator and writer. So when I get back to Under the Flesh, then we fine tune it. It's just going to be that much more special and worth the wait. So Under the Flesh, hang tight, Wayne, because I do have plans to finish that book.
Oh, good.
I'm not going to dilly-dally for long on that.
Well, it's tough when you're a creator. I mean, you know, once you start making things happen, other ideas come up. You know, you can't help it. You're a storyteller and other stories come to mind and you want to work on those too. It's really tough to know what to move forward with and do those kinds of things and which ones in what order, you know. But
I think what too was that Under the Flesh was, see, if I knew what I knew now, I'd do Under the Flesh differently in that I'd probably try to fund the whole thing outright like I did with Lair, like kind of fund everything. And do it as a trade paperback, because for me, it doing the ongoing thing, it was challenging. Mm-hmm. When I crafted, my game got a little bit better. I'm like, you know what? Let me just do the one shot. For me, it made more sense to do that. And I don't know why it just worked for me that way. Maybe other people it doesn't. But like for me, just it's like it's complete and it's done. We're on the Flesh, teasing it out through issue format, and then we hit some snag. It made things kind of difficult. Pistoletta, I kept the 30-page one shot. Lair one shot. I have another book that I'm going to do with Sebastian. It's an anthropomorphic type tale. like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles slash Star Wars. It's just crazy sci-fi action. That's also going to be a one-shot. That one's called Galactic Rodents of Mayhem. So it's just like one-shots have its thing for me where I feel like it works. But with Under the Flesh, I wrote it as a floppy, you know, single, you know, content, like an ongoing type, because that's what I thought would work. I thought I can pitch that. I could get published. Man, I'm learning the hard way that you just got to do it your own way to make it happen. So that's why it had to take a little backseat, but it's on hold, but it's not indefinitely, like, won't be continued. It will be continued. And I do have plans with JL to get back on that.
How many issues are in Under the Flesh when all is said and done?
When all said and done, I had it at 6 issues, with the last issue being a double issue. So if we want to nip, we could say 7 issues. So the idea I have for when I bring it back to Kickstarter, to crowdfunding, I have the first 3 issues done. I'm like giving that like for free. I could just put the whole 30 pages for people could just read it, whatever. This is where I'm at. And this is what we need to finish the chapter, like to finish it. And then the first 3 issues will just be those single floppy issues. You got them? Great. But it'll ultimately, we'll do like a trade paperback that fits everything in together in one complete story, like book one. And how that does, you know, will definitely, you know, could entertain a book two. But I just don't want to do the floppy all the way. So I just, instead of come back, oh, issue 4, issue 5, double issue 6, like we're just going to be like, hey, listen, this is what we have, all the content for free. This is for you. Just read it, see where we're at, because we need to get this done. And this is where we're at. So, you know, transparent, no holds barred. This is what we need to get this done. And me and JL will rock and roll with that. So hopefully we can, you know, do this, if not by closing out this year, definitely early next year. Under the Flesh is on track. So hopefully.
Okay. Well, cross, you know,
yeah. If for some reason JL is indisposed and he can't do it, I have to, you know, find a team then, what I didn't want to do, but I feel we can, me and JL, we can get this done. We both grew together as a writer and artist separately, and we're coming together. So I think that's just going to make Under the Flesh even stronger.
Great.
And that's what I'll do. I want to finish it with him.
Oh, great. Well, now, I know you ultimately like to do that, but, you know, I want the story. I'm a story guy, so I'm anxious to read the rest of the story. But you do good stuff, Gil, and all good things are going on. So say it again, the name of the book.
So we got Pistolera, A Blood-Soaked Tale of Scorn and Vengeance on Kickstarter. Definitely check it out if you dig Westerns, if you dig something fresh. Trust me, guys, you will not be disappointed. If you happen to back and you are disappointed, message me. I will give you your money back. No ands, ifs, or buts. That's how confident I am in my work.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and looking forward to the other books. I enjoyed Lair. I got to read that, and I liked that. And, of course, I'm a big fan of Under the Flesh, so I am dying to read more of your stuff. So keep up the good work. And,
you know, I appreciate the backing as well on all the projects I've done, man. You're the man, dude. I appreciate it from the beginning.
Well,
you're seeing the growth.
We're here for the long run, so keep it up. It's going to be good stuff.
Yeah. We'll do. We'll do. Thanks for having me.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
I'm talking with Lyndon White, the creator of a version of War of the Worlds, or an illustrated War of the Worlds, that is now being done on Kickstarter. How are you doing, Lyndon?
I'm good, thanks. You?
Good, good. Okay, talk to me a little bit about, I saw some of the things, so I'm really interested to know, It's called a concertina book. Is that, have I got that right?
Yeah, so it's a concertina book, also known as accordion books. And they're, I've done a few of them, and they're fold-out art books. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you have to tell a story in a series of illustrations. So these books only tend to have like 10, they're double-sided, and you've got about 10 images, so five images on either side. And the idea is that you can either read them like a normal book, mm-hmm. or you can flatten them out and display them as a piece of artwork.
Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't your first one of these books, my understanding. You've had two previous ones. Do you want to talk about those?
Yeah, sure. So this project came about 2 years ago because I did a Dracula illustration during some downtime. I freelanced full time, and I was just doodling in my journal while I was waiting for the painting to dry. And I was doodling like, oh, this is a cover for Dracula. Mm-hmm. So I did this cover for Dracula, and I'm on the Comic-Con circuit over here in UK, and for about a couple of months, everyone was going, oh, you're doing a Dracula book now, because I was selling this Dracula illustration print. And well, after a couple of conventions, I was like, well, I wasn't, but I'm now going to have to do something because people are asking for it. And I was unfortunately, I've been really thankful that I'm quite busy. I've got quite a lot of work on, so I couldn't really commit to doing Dracula as a comic or a graphic novel because it'd take about 2 years to do it properly, like, because it's quite a big book. So I decided to do the concertinas instead, which are I've been on my bucket list for a while. So I started with Dracula, and it was runaway success. We got I think the initial target was originally about £600, and we got just about 4.5, mm-hmm. Which meant that I could do extra bits and pieces. Like I managed to do Dante's Inferno through stretch goals, which was really fun. Mm-hmm. And then last year, on the anniversary of Dracula 1, which is the 14th of March, I did Lovecraft's The Call of Cthulhu. So I've done three so far, each based on a classic story, mostly in horror. And yeah, I'm back a year later now with H.G. Wells's The War of Worlds.
Have you kickstarted each one of them, or is this the first time?
So Dracula's the first Kickstarter, which then the stretch goal was Dante's Inferno. Then last year it was a Kickstarter for Call of Cthulhu. So this is my third Kickstarter for concertina books with War of Worlds. So it's like one a year.
So this has turned into a little cottage industry.
Yeah. Which is really nice because when I was making these books, they are a bit of a niche. Like there's only so many copies of Dracula you want on your bookshelf. So they're definitely aimed at people who are really interested in these classic stories. And thankfully, I've definitely found my fan base with them, because the people who really want them are really keen and really interested and really do want them. And I've had lots of suggestions about different books to do, and some of them I can't do because we need to be out of copyright. Mm-hmm. Got to make sure that whichever story I'm adapting is out of copyright, so it's all legal. Mm-hmm. But it's really good fun, and it's got to the point where I didn't want to do more than one a year because I didn't want to overdo it. I think because these books are very specific, mm-hmm. you don't want to overdo it. So I've set up for doing one a year, and thankfully each year people come back and support it. So it's all good. So we launched the War of Worlds yesterday, mm-hmm. and we've already hit up the initial target, which was £1,000.
Really?
And yeah, and we're halfway towards the first stretch goal, which is to give all backers a book plate, which is like a fancy small art print to go with the book. So it's all going really well. It's all positive.
Man, congratulations on your first day to do that.
Thank you. Yeah.
A lot of people would like to have that happen to them.
Yeah.
So
I mean, part of it was I pre-warned and like let people know it was coming. I sent like emails off to people about a month in advance before launch day. But I mean, I'm only aiming for £1,000, which is probably what, about $1,300 for you guys, mm-hmm. Which is not a massive amount, but it's the amount that I need to print the book. Mm-hmm. So it's aim small, And that's the lowest I could do the project for. And so anything extra from that is so not building on it.
You don't pay yourself then, basically. You this is just kind of... you said you've got other work that you're doing. And so for this, you all you need is the ability to print it, sounds like.
Yeah, so, I mean, because I like I was saying, they're quite niche when I first started doing them. I really didn't know what demand would be like. Mm-hmm. So I did all the artwork and all the work in my spare time, which is fine. You know, working in the evenings or day here or there. But I mean, it's only 10 images, so it's very manageable. Mm-hmm. But as the Kickstarters get into stretch goals, which we have each year, that's when I start getting to pay myself. So mm-hmm. As people support it and share the Kickstarter and it grows, it means that everyone's getting a little bit more for their money, but it's also paying me as well. So it's a bit of a different approach because, I mean, I've seen some Kickstarters that need, you know, a good couple of £1,000, which is sometimes quite difficult to reach, you know, especially with... Oh, did we go again for a second?
Oh, I'm here.
Okay. I think it's... You've got to be careful with your target goal on Kickstarter, because if you're aiming for a couple of £1,000, it's obviously a much harder target to reach straight away, especially if you're doing something new. Mm-hmm.
So that's, the good news is that it'll kind of help you. You know, if you have to do it totally for free, it's a labor of love for sure, but you've mm-hmm. got to be able to do more than do love things out of the love of the art. You got to support yourself too.
I mean, exactly. It's one of those things, like I was saying, that thankfully, because people have been supporting me with it, that these Kickstarters have gone way past their initial target, which means that I have got paid. I think it's the only, because of small projects, it's the only project that I work this way. Usually it's a case of, you know, making sure you are getting supported or getting paid, because, you know, especially if you're doing a comic or graphic novel, it takes a long time to make them. A lot of hours has to go into it.
Yeah. Now, before we get into a little more specifics on the book, I don't happen to be familiar with your previous work. Do you tend to do stuff over in the UK, or have you done American books? What kinds of stuff have you done so far?
So I've been freelancing for about 6 years, and it's mostly been in the UK comic scene. Over the past 2 years, I've been doing a lot of horror books. I've been working with it's a lot of small publishers over here. There's a bit of like a indie comics boom at the moment. So I've worked with Blue Fox Comics, which do a lot of horror. They do genre works of fantasy or sci-fi. They published my first graphic novel, which was Sparks from the Fallen Star, mm-hmm. which is a all ages graphic novel about a little robot that sets off to discover why the stars are going out. Mm. So it's like all ages children's book. Which has done really well. And I've done a number of books of them. I'm in their horror anthology series, Hexes, mm-hmm. which is a supernatural horror. I've done the artwork on two of their stories, and I'm also the letterer and the cover artist for the whole series, which is really fun to do. I've done a bunch of stuff. There's Comic House, which is like, it was a monthly anthology over here in the UK, mm-hmm. Which is Comic House is a online app, so they did like a print run of all these different short stories, and then they launched the app. It's almost like your Comixology, but a UK version. And I've done bits and pieces for Hellbound Media, so I'm currently the artist on the Mandy the Monster Hunter series, which is it's one of their staple books, and it's about Mandy, and she hunts monsters. And the series I've got is it's a four-part mini, which is The Legend of the Spindly Man. Mm-hmm. So Mandy's hunting down this monster, which is similar to the Slender Man, but mixed with a giant spider and a batterbug. So it's a big mishmash of horror. So there's loads of stuff. I think I've probably worked on over about 40 comics. Mm-hmm. Like individual issues and graphic novels. So there's definitely a good spread of stuff. It's one of those things that over in the UK, you try and you slowly start getting your work over there. I think people who have seen my work in the States has probably been through Kickstarters or ordering through crowdfunders, because that's become a lot more common. But I'm working there. I'm trying to work my way through the ladder, and it's just one of those things. It's like you do, depending on what comes through the door, what people get me work, what gets picked up, and what people have got me working on.
Interesting. Now, I noticed you tend to have a painted style in some of the stuff you've done. Is that your preferred way of illustrating stuff?
Yeah, so all my comics are like that. So I'm mixed media artist, so I use a mixture of ink, paint, pencils, watercolor. So it's like it's a bit more of a fine art approach. But instead of just typically, like, you sometimes only see that kind of artwork on the covers, but my books, it's on the interiors as well. So there's a lot of detail going into all the paints and the textures, which is one of the reasons why it works so well for horror books, and why I've got a lot of horror comic work, because people find that drawing monsters in that style actually helps bring out the horror elements of the story.
Interesting, because it's... You know, I like the painted style. I happen to prefer it because I Alex Ross, people like that. Some people say they're too realistic, but not for me. Mm-hmm. I like something that's a little more realistic. I mean, the costumes may look a little funny, but, you know, if you're doing something like yours, which is much more, you know, you're dealing less with superheroes and more with, you know, mythological type creatures and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So. Kind of interested in that. Now, one other thing I've noticed too about your books is that on the back cover, you usually have are you writing this, because there's it has Blue Fox Comics on the bottom, and then there's like a circle that includes text about the thing. Are you writing that?
So that is a retelling of the blurb of War of Worlds. Mm-hmm. So on occasion I do write as well. Mm-hmm. Sparks is one. Sparks graphic novel I mentioned. I wrote that one, and I don't get to do it all the time, but I do dabble a little bit. But obviously, if you're illustrating a book, that it takes time. You don't always get to do writing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do a little bit the text on the back of the Constantinas, because I want to make sure they have that narrative thread, because you have to. You meant to tell a full story in the illustrations. Having a bit of a blurb on the back does help. So there's a little bit about, that's from looking at a couple of different, for instance, War of the Worlds. That was looking at different versions of how the story is described, and then writing my own version of it, because it is an adaptation. You do put your own little spin on it.
Mm-hmm. But that's perfect lead into the next thing I wanted to ask about. And that is, you know, War of the Worlds was a rather lengthy book, and you're boiling it down to, you know, a smaller amount of pages. What was that like? I mean, don't you have to kind of function like an editor on some levels? You have to kind of pull out the parts that are probably graphically more interesting to you. How do you decide how to do this, take a written novel and turn it into graphics like this?
I get asked this a lot. It's so to begin with, I've seen and read and listened to multiple versions of War of the Worlds. So I put all that to one side and I went back to the book and I reread the book. But as I was reading it, any key scene or chapter or visual that I thought was important or interesting, I wrote it down. I wrote it down as a big list. So as I've read through the book, I've got this list building up, which I think I had about 40 scenes or 40 key points. And, you know, when I'm writing these down, I know that I'm being strict, or some I'm thinking that's a really interesting visual. That's how I choose them. So I've got this list, and then once I've got it, I then decide what is the start point, the middle, and the end, because that will give me 3 panels out of the 10 that I've got to play with. Because if I know where it starts, I know where it ends, I know where the midpoint is roughly, I can then fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. So using those, I then decide what are the key moments between the middle and the start, and the middle and the end. And it kind of like fills in itself. And then you review it's, it sounds really structured. It sounds quite simple when I'm saying it like that, but that's it. once you realize that you've got those key points, like my starting point was a falling star as the Martian craft falls to Earth. So I knew that was my first visual. Things like that really do help you break it down, and you realize that you have to cut certain things. Like in the book, there's halfway through, it switches to a couple of chapters about the narrator's brother who lives in London, and it follows the events of him trying to escape London and the Martians coming, and eventually he escapes by getting on a boat and gets out to sea and to safety. All that has to be axed because it just made it too confusing for such a short book. So little things like that, if anything in there is going to make it a bit more confusing or less clear, it had to go or be edited or changed a little bit, because especially like if someone's not as familiar with War of the Worlds as someone who's read it or heard a radio play or seen a film, you really need to make it digestible.
Okay. How long does it take you, basically? I mean, from the, let's say you decide you're going to do War of the Worlds until you get to the finished project. How long does it take you, like, to do the editing and then to do the actual artwork of it?
The actual artwork. So I think I spent, in terms of making artwork, I spent about a week and a half getting all the artwork finished. So from sketches to finished, which is a nice short turnaround time. And that included editing and tweaking and messing with the logo and things like that. Before then, I was obviously reading the book and making notes. But thankfully, I was this year. I don't get to do it every year, but this year I could actually take the... I took two solid weeks off to just work on this, which was just... It just happened to really easily fit into like a time slot with the other books I'm working on. So, it was easy this year. Like some years I've had to do it in the evenings or... like on the weekends, like leading up to the Kickstarter campaign going live, because you've got to balance it. But yeah, I mean, it's these concertinas, they are definitely a smaller part of my work, but one that's definitely got a popular fan base.
It's interesting because that's not the way that many comics, as you know, working in comics, this is not a size or a format that a lot of people use in the industry right now. But, you know, there are books that excel when they break that format, like Mouse Guard was a good one. You know, it's a size that doesn't match the rest of the stuff on the stand. And there are others like it. But do you find that it helps in the appeal for the book? I mean, because it's different from what else is out there?
Yeah, I definitely think so. When I was telling some writers and artist friends of mine that I was going to do Dracula, I was telling them how I was going to do it, and they didn't quite wrap their head around it because we hadn't come across the concertina format. So showing people and like making mock-ups and visuals helps, but it's a bit of a lost book format. Like, you don't even see much of it in the UK anymore. I think the only time I really see it is if I'm at a art show or maybe a, you know, like a zine festival or something like that, where people have made themselves. It's, I think you don't see them very often because usually when they're made, they're not telling a story. I think that's why they've become lost a little bit, because you'd see these concertinas and each image would look incredible, but they'd be, apart from being made by the same creator, the same artist, there wouldn't be a through line story, so you could look at it, but you couldn't really get much out of it. But I have found that people who aren't necessarily comic readers, or like if you go to a Comic Con and someone's there just for the, you know, the films or TV, which, you know, we want people to be there for the comics, but not everyone is. And it does catch their attention. And I've had a number of people who've bought these books who now read my comics and have actually started reading comics. So, which is nice, because it's not exactly the original intention. I was trying to target part of my audience that already liked my work, but it has introduced new people to my work completely. Particularly like, I found that sometimes someone might like Dracula, but won't like Cthulhu. So it's sort of like they'll pick and choose as well. Like, some people will get all of them. Some people will go, actually, I'm not that bored about Inferno, but I love Dracula and Cthulhu, so they'll pick and choose ones that they like, which is nice because it's the same for any book on the shelf. Not everyone's going to want to buy everything.
That's good.
Yeah,
it's a fascinating thing because I like things that are different. I like things that stand out and, you know, appeal to my need for variety and things like that. So I'm just kind of curious because I noticed, too, in some of the images you sent to me, there are, looks like, wall plaques of some of the books. There's, like, two plaques where it looks like there's five images on one and then five on another. And then you've got all four books illustrated up that way up there. Is that self-done? Is that something people... How do you get that done? Well, let's say you'd buy the book and you wanted to do this kind of a thing. How would you do that?
Those frame sizes are quite easy to get a hold of. If you go into any place that sells, you know, if you art frames, they probably will have the size. It's just like a longer frame. Over here, it's either IKEA, Range, Wilkinson's. I'm not sure what the American equivalent is. But they're actually quite accessible. It's purposely when I've been making these books and decided what size I was going to make them, I want to make sure that they are kind of an art piece. So the ones that those mock-ups that I've made, I made those before the Kickstarter went live, so I could get a visual for how they actually look on the wall. They're based on what you can actually get, and those are, if you've got two copies, that's when you can display both sides, because that's how they were displayed. Traditionally, if you bought a concertina, that's how you display them. You'd, if you want to, say you're someone who just wants it as like a book, you can flick through it like a normal book and use it that way. But too, if you're after it as more of an art piece, that's when some people go, actually, I'll buy a second copy because I want to display both sides, or they buy one copy and then switch it around every now and again. It is a bit different. I think it's why it's got a bit of a new audience for me, because people are looking for art, they or are interested in something for home, they get them, which I do get messages from people, and some people have these up in their home, like it's not sat on the bookshelf, or they've bought two copies, one's on the bookshelf and one's on the wall, because they want to display it, which is quite nice. I guess if you're still trying to wrap your head around it as a audio listener, it's something that you can either have on as a book, or you can have as a long piece of artwork. So it's almost like a print and comic book.
No, the way I understand it, there's no like hardcover to it. There's just you just unfold it, and it's a complete document by itself.
Yeah, that's right.
Does it come in like a slip cover or something to keep the pages together, or are they just individual? It's just the concertina version.
So it's all on one long sheet of paper, and it's folded. So there's no staple bound or anything like that. It's just the folds of one long sheet of paper. But something we've done with stretch goals is that when it's got to a certain point, the stretch goal hits it, we put it in an envelope with a wax seal, so that there's like a little finish of again something a bit special when it arrives in your post. It's actually got a wax seal on it, stressed to you, so it's that's like a little extra thing we've tried to do in the past, which we managed to do it with Dracula and Cthulhu, so hopefully we'll be able to do it this time as well. But we've got to, you know, get the stretch goals, because otherwise I don't want to be wax sealing books and envelopes without getting, you know, paid for it, because it takes a long time to do.
Now, as I was looking at the files you sent to me, each page has its own name. And yet when I look at the page, I don't think I see the names on the page. Is there any, do you send along like a paper that explains all these things, or... Because, like, for example, the first page is called The Falling Star. You know, it's obviously that's when the ship appears for the first time. And then there's The Pit, and Ray Gun, and Home, and Into the Storm, Fire, Water, The Red Weed, Underfoot, The Fallen. And I'm just kind of... Are those titles available any place in the concertina book?
No. The only text on the actual book is the cover, which has a War of Worlds on it, and then the blurb. The rest, it's purely silent, so it's just using the image. So they are named, each page is named after either a chapter or one of those phrases from the book. It's almost essentially if you bought a piece of artwork, the artwork's usually named, but it's not actually written on the, the piece of work. Mm-hmm. It's like that. It's one of those things that that'll be a little extra that you get if you're a bit more familiar with War Worlds, you'll get it. But if not, then you know it's just a casual read.
Hmm. Interesting. So I'm just going to be fascinated because, well, I've got to ask because I often ask artists in particular this: Do you sell the individual pages? Like, let's say. Well, of course, that goes right back to the question is, are you doing this on the computer or are you doing this by hand? How are you doing this? And if depending on the way you do it, if you do it by hand, of course, you could sell the individual pages to people who wanted to buy them. How do you make this happen? And does that influence, you know, what happens after the book comes out?
Okay, so I do half button half. So I pencil ink everything by hand. So it's inked in gray wash. So if you basically black and white ink, it looks very similar to watercolor. And then I color the images digitally. So the original pieces of artwork are just the black and white versions. Mm. I changed how I work. I used to paint everything by hand. Mm. But the downside is it takes much longer to do. Mm. And I also found out I'm partly colorblind, which makes painting color sometimes quite difficult. So it took a while to, because it's one of those things that you don't realize until someone points it out to you, and then you have to like figure out ways of like, you have to wrap your head around that you're not seeing color the same as everyone else. So I changed the way I worked and I do the coloring digitally now. So I've made a color palette, which I can clearly see and I understand it. And I've got like it sectioned out, so I'm like, these colors are for grass and forest, these colors are for night skies, and it sometimes means that my color palettes are a bit more surreal or a bit different, but thankfully people still like the work, and I think it helps my style as an artist because it makes something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But the originals, the pencil ink drawings are on the Kickstarter for sale. It's pop, and 6 out of 9 of them have sold already. Wow. Which is a nice thing to have. It's been a very good day and a half at this point. And it was the same for the past ones. Like I think out of all the other Constantina books, I've got none of the original art left. It's all sold, which really? Is lovely. Yeah, it's a really nice problem to have.
I've got to ask, just because I mean, you worked on this and you made this stuff and it turned out superbly and people really like it. Is it tough to get rid of that artwork that you've created, or, you know, does it kind of help keep you afloat? In other words, if you can sell these kinds of things and so you can't get too attached to this, and you probably make a lot of art in your time. And so it's just something that you know is part of the game that you're going to have to at some point part with it.
Yeah, I think it's something you do have to part with stuff, because particularly if you work in comics and publishing and books like I do, you end up with a big stack of pages and you can't really keep them all. And then all of a sudden you look around your studio and you just like, there's just mountains of paper here. And I do have pages that I absolutely love and pieces that I really do like, but then it's also the fact that knowing that people are going to get enjoyment out of it is great, because people do ask for the originals. And it's also, from my perspective, is that you're, as an artist or an illustrator or creator, you always want to be getting better. Mm-hmm. And something that I do now, I might love it today, and in 6 months I might hate it because I'll see what I would have done differently, or it'll be silly things like I've done a line somewhere and I'll think, oh, I've messed it up because I've done this line like that, and you won't have noticed it at the time. And that's because you've gotten that little bit better or you've spotted something. So I've gotten quite good at parting with my art, which, again, it's nice that people want it and want those pencil and ink drawings. But I've got, again, because I've been working on comics, I've got plenty of plenty of pages sat around the studio in piles from different projects.
But do you keep some of it, though? I mean, let's say if you do one that you particularly like, you don't part with it? Or have you gotten to, you know, I can't imagine working on something like that for that many hours and then to suddenly let it fly, I mean, let it go on its own. I'd find that difficult to do. It sounds like, though, you've kind of got mastered all that stuff and kind of figured all that out.
Yeah. It'll be famous last words. I'll do something next week and I'll never want a part of it. But I think there's like one or two book. There's two main books I'm working on at the moment. And aside from Constantine book's finished, or War of the Worlds is. But the graphic novel I'm working on now, there's one or two pages I've done for that, and I really do like them. And it's one of those things that I'll keep them for now. And I'm thankfully in that stage where the book isn't out, and it might not even be out until the end of the year or next year. So I've got plenty of time before anyone's going to want the artwork for it. So I've got time to make up my mind. But yeah, I think I have got to that stage where I'm mostly happy to get rid of artwork if people want it.
Yeah, hey, and if it helps, you know, keep you going and make other projects possible, hey, that works.
I understand that. Yeah, I think that's what with freelancing you have to definitely understand that your revenue and your income is going to come from different avenues, and some of it's going to be from selling art, some of it's going to be from making new art. You might have to every now and again take on like a non-comic job or a corporate job that isn't as fun, but it pays bills. So, you know, I think you just become flexible to it all.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm kind of curious because you tend to choose, at least so far, like classic stories, you know, War of the Worlds, Dracula, and Cthulhu, all those good things are stories that probably most people have known. You are creating different stories, you know, in other places. Have you ever thought of doing one of these, say, with an original story that you come up with?
The Constantine. Yeah. I've not been that tempted, to be honest. I think because of anything but I'm writing, I'm instantly writing in script format and thinking it in terms of a comic. And I absolutely love comic format. I love making... I absolutely love doing sequentials. And I think that if I'm going to make something that's completely my own, I like the idea that I'm going to be able to tell it in its complete format. I think the good part of the Constantine thing is that these stories exist in those other formats. Like, I'm pretty sure you could find a radio play, a musical, or a book. Possibly, I don't think there's a graphic novel of War of the Worlds, but there's different options there. Whereas if I made my own story in one of these Constantinas, if I'm going to make a story, it's just going to be in about one format. I'd prefer to do it as a comic. And that's just me. I think that's partly because if I'm on writing duty, it tends to be for a comic. It doesn't really tend to be for anything else.
So what have you written? I'm just kind of curious because how many stories have you actually written as far as like... Because, you know, it sounds like art is kind of, you know, I always ask people who are writer artists, which comes first, the writer or the artist? And it seems like the artist comes first based on what I'm seeing. But, I mean, how does that work with you? I mean, do you prefer the writing? Do you prefer the, or are you, a storyteller that it's all part of the same process as long as you tell stories?
Yeah, I think the best way of describing it is it's making it, from a story perspective, is like following a recipe. So if I'm writing, I'm starting the dish that I'm making, and then, or if I'm just on art duty, someone else is starting and he'll like tap me in to finish cooking whatever he's started. But I mean, comics are collaborative, so it depends. I'm definitely artist first. But I'm incredibly narrative focused. I absolutely love stories and storytelling. So the books that I get to work on, I 90% of the time I'm involved in the story, even if I'm not writing it. I'm helping edit it, or I'm chipping in at story plot points or things like that, even before we get to visuals, because I love doing that stuff, and it's part of it. Every now and again, you'll get something that the script's always finished, and they're just looking for an artist. So you know that work's been done. Mm-hmm. But I definitely say that I'm writer second, and I think I'm definitely a writer second because I don't get to do it very often because of a workload. So I've written Sparks, which is a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. I also wrote The Mind of James Sevengal with Jordan Sam Adams, which is a psychedelic thriller about a guy trying to deal with his post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. It's quite surreal and heavy, tackles a lot of adult themes. Mm-hmm. And that one I wasn't on script writing, but I was writing down plot points, and it was a case of once me and Jordan settled on it, he then went and did the script, and I did the artwork afterwards. And other things, I've did a one-shot zombie comic called Lost and Found a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and that was all pencil and ink, with a bit of red to highlight the artwork, and that was about a father and a daughter have an argument in a city. This is after the zombie infestation has happened, and she storms out, and it's about him trying to get her and save her before she gets bitten. So it's like a against the clock kind of thing. It all wrapped up in about 30 pages. It was one of the first things I did, actually. Did all right. I think that was when I was first starting out. And again, around some of the time period, I did a comic called Pinnacle, mm-hmm. which was about, that was a silent comic, which is actually like interesting because the Constantinus have no text. So this comic Pinnacle was about a man lost in a blizzard trying to get to the top of a mountain, mm-hmm. and a monster is chasing him. And that's it. There's no dialogue. It's just the visual. So it was all snow, and it was really fun to draw because you got to play around with the weather effects and the monster behind in the snow as it's trying to hunt him down. Mm-hmm. And then the main thing that I'm working on at the moment is a graphic novel called Candles, mm-hmm. which I'm writing and I'm drawing it. Candles is about a young girl and her quest to steal magic from an evil witch, mm-hmm. and use it to save a dying village. So it's very Brothers Grimm, Studio Ghibli-esque. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I've just spouted out a couple of different projects there, like one of you. No. But so Candles is, I finished writing that a few months ago, and I spent the last 4 months of last year getting the artwork finished, not the artwork, the line work. So I've got a visual for every page now, and I'm now working my way through the inks and colors. So in terms of like time scale, I think it was four and a half months, nearly pushing five, and I did about 120 pages of just drawing, just getting the line work done, and going back through and editing it and getting it all polished. It's with my editor at the moment. She's just giving it a once, like another look over before I start throwing ink and paint at it. But yeah, that's fun to work on. It's fun to, I've spent the last, most of the last 2 years doing horror books, so it's been nice to jump on Candles and do a bit of fantasy and something a bit more lighthearted.
Is that kind of your favorite genre? Is that horror, or like you said, sometimes it's good to do other kinds of storytelling?
I think I've fallen into horror because I did one book about 3 years ago for Blue Fox Comics, one of the Hexus books, mm-hmm. The supernatural horror ones. And it wasn't until then that that was my first real horror book. And then that's when everyone kind of saw, oh, Lyndon can do a horror book. You know, he can draw monsters like this. And that's when I started getting offers of like, oh, we've got a horror book, which I think your style would be perfect for. And it just kind of like, that's sort of like a wave that I was on for about 2 years because I'm just getting more work from it, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. But I was just finishing off Mandy, the Monster Hunter series. And it was after that, I was like, I could have easily picked up another horror book and, you know, had a really fun time doing it. I love everything I get to work on. Mm. But I thought it was good to have a bit of a palate cleanse and also get back to doing one of my own stories because I'd spent so long. I think Sparks came out at the end of 2016. So it's been quite a while since I've been able to do like a graphic novel size thing that I've written just by myself. And also I had it was either Candles or one other project that I was pitching, and it was a case of a coin flip of which one got picked up, and Candles was the one that got chosen. But yeah, I'm really lucky that I've been able to pick what I get to work on, and I, like I said, I absolutely have a blast doing all this stuff. I absolutely love making comics.
Well, I wanted to tell you how much I really appreciate the artwork, how much I like the look of it. I've told you I like the painted feel. My favorite one is the fifth image. I think that's the ship, sort of a bug-like image.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my favorite one. I mean, that one just kind of jumps off the page at me when I look at it. Really, awesome. Really something. And a lot of the other pages I really like too. It's really, really strong artwork with, you know, that painted feel that I love so much. And it kind of transports me into the story really well. Mm-hmm. And I got a chance to look over the other ones too. And I think that same thing, I think you're getting better and better as you go along. You started off well. And I think this War of the Worlds, I think, is the best one. So if you've liked the other ones, I think you're going to really enjoy War of the Worlds, because I just think it's just, I love the use of color, the ability to put like the feeling of direness sometimes into mm-hmm. it, as well as the really interesting, you know, dynamics that you put into it too. I think it's just all really, it's really vibrant and you know, scary on the same levels. Mm-hmm. So I like that real well. I just think that they're all really good and strong, and I think you've picked the right field with horror. I think horror works so well with your art style.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure you can do others. I'm sure there's other things that you can do that do with Sparkle just as well. I think it's just really terrific stuff. And I like the concertina thing too. I love the... Oh, man, if I had room on my walls, I would put this up there. I'd have it up. It's really glorious.
Yeah, it's always finding a wall space for it. But thank you. It's nice to hear. I think it's going back to that thing of saying that you always want to be getting better. And like I said, like Dracula, Inferno, I'm happy with. And, you know, same with Cthulhu. But I like to think that each year I am getting better as an artist, which I think is what everyone wants. And, one thing I did want to make sure with War of the Worlds that the colours really popped. You got the vibrant colours because, you know, some of these books can be, like a lot of horror set at night time, so you have to find ways to make it look vibrant and bright when it's quite dark. But yeah, that image you were talking about, the first one that pops out to you, that was the first one I got to work on. So that's when I nailed down the robot design or the mech design, the tripod, and got to play around with the lightning and stuff.
Yeah, and the feeling of like red and fire kind of, and yellow, the uses of red and yellows that make it, it gets that feeling of, like I said, fire and other things going on to it too, the electricity and stuff. You get that feeling of danger, which I really like. Mm-hmm. Especially, you're right, you got like mostly night skies in the background and stuff, so it stands out real well. It's just really beautiful stuff. I really liked it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's when they actually get printed and they actually start arriving at people's doors, they actually get to see, like, sometimes the screen doesn't always show all the textures and the paints that well, but when it's actually in print, you actually get to see all those ink marks and things that make it pop even more. Thank you.
Now, I'm just kind of curious, because let's say somebody doesn't get to hear about your Kickstarter and doesn't get to get the book through that means, are there other means that you can get that? Is one of the publishers you're working with, are they going to publish it as well?
Yeah, so Blue Fox Comics, once they published it, once it was all finished, and helped distribute and get around the con circuit, mostly in the UK, some overseas, but it's one of those things with sometimes working with a smaller publisher. But you'll be able to get it from Blue Fox Comics, or you'll be able to get it from my website. So it's lyndonwhite.com. It's as my name is spelled. If you clicked on the podcast, you'll probably find the correct spelling.
Yeah, Lyndon, Lyndon, just for people who might be wondering about that. Now, as I see on here on your news release, you're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. mm-hmm. as well, so we can follow you there, which is a good thing. Now, the important information we need to get out is that the ending date for this Kickstarter, according to your release, is April the 11th. And let me take a quick glance.
That's correct.
Which day that is, just so we can plan for. Oh, it's a Thursday.
It's Thursday, yeah.
Yeah, that's
interesting. So it ends on Thursday, the 11th of April at 11:30 UK time. So that'll be what? Nearly
6:30.
Six thirty in the morning for you guys. So yeah, so really the last time you guys are probably gonna see it is maybe the 10th of April. But yeah, it's still got a long way to go. We're only on the second day of the campaign, so there's still 28 days.
Well, I mean, things are going really well, which is just fantastic. And you've got all these kinds of stretch goals that you're going to be able to get. I think that now's the time to jump on, because you get to do all these good things and get all this wonderful artwork that you're making and stuff.
Yeah.
So, Lyndon, I really loved it. It was wonderful stuff. I'd wish you more success, I think, but you've got already enough success. You've got your Kickstarter funded, which, as I said before, I think a lot of people would love to have that. So cherish that while you've got it. That's a wonderful thing. And you're going to, I think, do a lot better by the time this is all done. And again, I said, go to Kickstarter and look for, what should they look for, Lyndon?
If you type in War of the Worlds into Kickstarter, it'll come up. Or if you go to my website, lyndonwhite.com, you'll be able to find it there. But yeah, or you can follow me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at LyndonDraws, and you'll see multiple posts or process drawings of the book. So I've got some videos of me inking the paintings and things like that. So there's plenty of stuff to check out.
Great stuff. Well, Lyndon, it's wonderful stuff. I'm so glad you did this and you made it available to us that we can get it. And I always like to say that Kickstarter is a place that, you know, we get to see stories we wouldn't see without it. So I'm very happy that you're using Kickstarter, and it makes it available to us in the U.S., and to other countries, I'm sure, who would like to be able to access your work and be able to enjoy it. So, man, keep it up. I think you're doing terrific stuff. And, man, I'm fascinated to see where you end up with these good things. Oh, well, let me ask one other question before you go. Have you already started thinking about what you're going to do next?
Not for next year. I've got time to think about it. I've got, well, just under a year to think about what to do next. But most of the past 3 books have come from people's suggestions, so as long as it's out of copyright and it's, you know, pretty much anything's doable in concertina format, so I'm always open to suggestions.
Cool, very cool. Well, it's nice to know that you might have an influence on what you're going to do next. So great stuff. Do you go to I'm sorry to keep asking questions, but do you go to cons over in the UK, or have you ever come to the US for a con?
I usually do about 10 to 15 a year in the UK. So I'm at London, Manchester, Birmingham. I'm up and down all over the place. Mostly a lot of the MCM shows. Mm-hmm. I haven't made it overseas yet. It's something I really want to do, but I'm trying, because I'm still fairly young in my career, I'd say. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find that right point to come over. And it's one of those things that when I've got something on the books with an American publisher, that's probably going to be the time where I'll make the leap. So it's just a waiting game at the moment while I'm working on some stuff.
Well, I've got a couple
yeah.
suggestions for you. I think that New York would be wonderful. Probably one of the closer cons to you as far as, like, physically, you know, you'd fly into New York, which is usually easy to get to. And because you like science fiction, I've been pushing this a lot lately. Awesome Con in Washington, D.C., which is a big sci-fi hub, is another good place to go. It's New York, of course. Everybody wants to go to San Diego. San Diego is a great place to go. But I these days prefer New York, so I would recommend that. If you have a choice, you might think about that. But these are just suggestions. Whatever works best for you, it would be fun to see. It'd be great to stop by and see you there and be able to say hi.
Yeah, well, thanks for the tip. It's always good to hear what people think, because you know, getting over there from the UK is, you know, quite an expense, so you have to pick your moment, I guess.
Well, Lyndon, it's great talking with you. We'll have to do this again next year, maybe. We'll have to make it a yearly thing. When you do your book, we'll have to we'll talk about your big things and get things done, because I think that it's, I love the variety of it. I love that it challenges different parts of my thinking that, you know, other things don't. So I love that. So you'll have to just keep it up so we can do this again next year.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Thanks again for having me.
Next week, episode 375. But until then, keep reading your comics.
So I leave, knowing that a world full of heroes has nothing to fear.